You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
First of all, Russia's invasion of Ukraine. How is that related to geopolitics of space? It seems very like a lawless kind of little zone, but now we're bringing our earthly conflicts into outer space. What's going on there?
Well, yeah, so it's obviously the ISS has been orbiting since the year 2000, and that is a joint mission between the US and Russia principally, and then there's Europeans and other nations involved. And so among the biggest questions and what's going to sort of happen in space is the fate of the International Space Station. And it's currently, it's home, or I think it was yesterday or the day before, three new Russian cosmonauts arrived at the ISS. And I don't know if you saw in the news, they were all wearing bright yellow jumpsuits, so in the color of the Ukraine flag, and that was played down, I think, by the Russian sort of administration. But I mean, it was fairly a clear statement in support of Ukraine, I think. And it's not clear how the ISS is going to endure if the relations between the two biggest nations involved are so fractious. And there are other collaborations as well that are throwing up new challenges as Russian and Western nations are pulling out of joint projects. And the war is really ending partnerships that began three decades ago to bridge the divide between Russia and the rest. And it will fracture the relationships built after the end of the Cold War. Now, by design, the ISS relies on Russia working together with the US and 14 other nations. Part of the station is Russian built and operated by cosmonauts. The other part is built and run by the US, and also the European, Japanese, and Canadian space agencies are involved. Each is dependent on the other for key services. So the NASA side provides the electrical power to the Russian side, while the Russian side provides the orbital boosting that is occasionally needed to stop the ISS falling into lower altitudes and disintegrating in Earth's atmosphere.
It's quite a stark change from, you know, this race to space of the 60s between, you know, the US and Russia, eh?
Oh, absolutely. And it's been three decades of really positive, good collaboration. And according to NASA, the space station is operating as usual. No one on the space station, at least, has said anything publicly about the invasion of Ukraine. But on Earth, the tensions are a lot more apparent. So the head of Russia's space agency, a guy called Dmitry Rogozin, has been posting provocatively on social media, including tweeting a video of technicians taping over the flags of other nations on a Russian-built Soyuz rocket. And a Russian state-owned media organization produced a satirical video showing the Russian components of the ISS detaching from the rest, so separating completely. So NASA's trying to paint a positive picture. Clearly, they're heading for some sort of situation. I don't know exactly what's going to happen, whether the Russians will continue working with the Americans in space. It seems likely there's going to be some sort of change. And there are others more broadly. The space partnerships are fraying along these sort of geopolitical lines. So the country has halted launches from Europe spaceport in French Guiana. They've stopped rocket engine sales to the United States. Russia's no longer working with NASA on a planned mission to Venus. ESA, for instance, is looking for a new ride for its Mars mission after its launch on a Russian rocket, which was supposed to go later this year, was cancelled. And there's instruments in astronomy experiments around the world that are being turned off because they are Russian built, and they're stopping science observations sort of around the world. So it's a difficult situation, and it's ongoing. But it seems like this is ringing in big changes for collaboration in science and in space.
It's kind of scary to see how far-reaching these consequences have gone because, again, like you'd think space is kind of beyond the realms of conflict on Earth, because, you know, people have to collaborate up there. You know, what are you gonna do otherwise, right? And it's kind of a big blow for research, I suppose.
Right, and I think it shows, you know, on a personal level, I think that the astronauts and cosmonauts and the Europeans and whoever is up in the space station, you know, they are collaborators. They get on. They have to work together. And this has been, you know, over the last 20 plus years, it's shown that these big nations can work together. But obviously, it's events down on Earth that will change things and stop the flow of cosmonauts or astronauts to the space station. And probably, I suspect, herald the sort of the early demise of that installation in space.
Moving on to our second topic today, a simple electrical circuit is now capable of learning on its own without the help of a computer, which is a little bit scary. So I'm hoping you'll kind of ease my fears about, you know, a robot takeover.
Yes, no, this isn't that. So we're sort of getting used to the idea that computers can sort of recognize things. They already recognize our faces. They can recognize our writing. They can recognize the objects shown in pictures. And this is using artificial intelligence systems, and they can do really astonishing feats. But they all require pretty hefty computing. But this report was a tiny circuit which has been able to show that it can teach itself without any help from a computer. So they're saying this is akin to a living brain. And this sort of is a way to potentially avoid the massive amount of computation that's typically required to tune an artificial intelligence system, which is an issue that could become more of a roadblock as these programs grow increasingly complex.
That's crazy, eh? So, like, how does that even happen?
So currently, the standard tool, so this is all about machine learning, making machines learn to do things that, you know, we sort of take for granted. But the standard tool for machine learning is something called an artificial neural network. And these networks typically only exist, they're sort of the virtual networks, they exist in the computer's memory. And they consist of points or nodes, and each of which can take a value that ranges from 0 to 1, connect, and these are connected by lines or edges, and each connection is weighted by a certain amount depending on how correlated or anti-correlated nodes are. It's very, very complicated, but if you imagine a big web of nodes and interconnected points that is able to learn to recognize different inputs. So it could be someone's handwriting, it could be different types of flowers, it could be recognizing faces or whatever it is. In order to teach this system, the developers typically expose it to a set of training pictures and adjust the weights of the edges to get the right output. So, you know, if you want your neural network to recognize, you know, a particular face, then you give it 1,000 faces or 1,000,000 faces, teach it to recognize a particular feature or whatever. And once it's done that, you can then let it loose and it will go ahead and recognize faces. But in this work, scientists have developed a system that can do that they've done it by sort of randomly wiring together 16 common electrical components called adjustable resistors. And they're just like little antennas. And each resistor serves like an edge on this network, and the nodes are junctions where the resistors, the leads all meet and meet together. And to use in the networks, the researchers set voltages for certain input nodes and read out the voltages from other nodes, and adjusting the resistors is akin to making the network learn how to give the desired output for a given set of inputs.
Just with voltages, just kind of turning them on,
right,
and off.
Exactly. So it's always like a physical manifestation of what is normally a virtual network in the memory of a computer, but it's now just built with little bits of wire.
That is incredibly impressive.
It is, and it's not, I mean, it's complicated, but in its sense, in itself, this little network is not actually that complex. And it was able to tune it to perform a variety of simple AI tasks. So it could distinguish with greater than 95% accuracy between 3 species of iris, the flower, depending on 4 physical measurements of a flower, like the length and the width of the petals and so on. That's sort of a canonical AI test that uses a standard set of 150 images, and 30 of which we use to train the network. So it can do basic things. It's by no means an advanced artificial intelligence system, but it's an interesting example, and it seems unlikely that this will ever replace a standard sort of neural network.
No, but it will help, wouldn't it?
It could, but it's not out of the question that this might have some technological utility. So if it's made out of an electrical component or electrical components, then you can scale it down. You might be able to scale it down to a microchip size. And I think that's probably where they're headed with this. So it's a physical manifestation of this sort of virtual network.
Amazing. And also amazing, our last topic for today's episode of Dear Science, scientists have been able to look at nearly the entire genome of an embryo that's been created via IVF, which is so cool. So what's going on there?
So this is sort of really impressive. So we were sort of familiar with scientists taking adult cells and reading out a whole genome. But to do it on IVF-created embryos is really remarkable. So this is a really challenging feat because of the tiny, tiny volume of genetic material that's available for analysis. And this advance depends on, so this is a California company that have done this, or they say they've done this, and it depends on fully sequencing both parents' DNA and sort of reconstructing an embryo's genome with the help of the data that they can get from the embryo. And this company is suggesting it could make it possible to forecast the risk for common diseases that could develop decades down the line. Now, currently, this sort of genetic risk prediction is being tested in adults and sometimes offered clinically, but it's still early days. And so the idea of applying it to IVF embryos has generated a lot of scientific and ethical controversy, but it hasn't really stopped the technology from galloping ahead anyway. So, you know, things like heart conditions, autoimmune diseases, cancer, many other adult ailments have very complicated and sort of mysterious origins that are fueled by certainly a mix of genetic and environmental influences. And there's hundreds of variations in the human genome that can collectively raise or lower the risk of a particular disease. It's not like you have a switch for some sort of heart condition or a cancer or something like that. It's usually much more complicated than that. And so predicting a person's chance of a specific illness by blending all this genetic variability remains under study in adults, in part because our understanding of how gene variants come together to drive or protect against disease remains sort of a work in progress. And in embryos, it's even harder prove a sort of risk, a risk score or something like that, and to prove how it could be accurate. So ultimately, the question is, how are you going to validate an embryo? You know, you'd have to wait 40 or 50 years to find out whether that person develops the diseases that they were screened for as an embryo.
Even if you can potentially map these genetic disorders that might pop up later in life, what are the ethics that you mentioned before? So I can definitely see an issue arising where if you're selecting like an IVF baby, what is the ethics of kind of choosing one over another?
So part of it is you know, you might be able to find out some of this information, but, you know, you're not really going to know whether this information is accurate for a long period of time. So are you selling parents a product or a service that is not proven or is unreliable? A lot of researchers are saying it's premature to do these risk assessments on embryos, and they're acknowledging or they're recognizing the score's limitations or the risk, like risk score that they produced, and they're also saying that they are based on DNA from populations of overwhelmingly European ancestry, and they're probably very much less accurate in other groups. And there are also a lot of concerns about the accuracy, certainly in adults. It's improved in adults, but it's still not sure. It's not clear how reliable these sort of analyses are. So they've used computer modeling to assess whether the height or IQ of a person can be produced by selecting embryos using these sort of polygenic risk scores, and that opens up a whole nother Pandora's box of ethical sort of issues, because you could then maybe select for a taller baby or a smarter baby or whatever, you know, this is now almost shopping for your own baby.
Mm. It's leaning dangerously into eugenics territory, isn't
it? Exactly, absolutely. Yeah. So all of these early studies on embryos and the genetic profile of embryos is really, really, really dicey and can quite easily, you know, some parents would love to be able to select for a particular trait, given the choice. And so you can see that these companies are trying to push as hard as they can to try and get to that level, whereas, you know, the ethical considerations, as usual, are sort of lagging behind but need to be considered fast before the ability to sort of almost select your own baby comes to the fore.
Mm, but it's still early days, isn't it? So we'll just have to keep an eye on that, as with most scientific developments that we see in the world of science.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.